Right. Well, thanks everybody for joining us. This is Caroline Fredrickson. I'm the director of the Washington Legislative Office of the American Civil Liberties Union. I'm joined here today by Ana Avendano, who's with the AFL-CIO, the Associate General Counsel and Director of the Immigrant Worker Program, and on the phone by John Trusvina, who's President of MALDEF and General Counsel. We've come together. We represent organizations that do a great amount of advocacy work, including work in the courts, and we wanted to address some of what we see are the significant shortcomings of the immigration bill that is being debated in the Senate as we speak. And I'd like to open up with a few general points about the concerns of the ACLU, but first, just a couple points of process. This call will be recorded, and for anyone who'd like further information about the ACLU's perspective, you can go to our landing page, which is www.aclu.org, and our press line is 202-675-2312. Please don't hesitate to follow up. And so the immigration bill, and what are the problems? From the ACLU's point of view, this bill is completely unwieldy, unworkable, and unrealistic. Without significant change, it will be seen as a highly flawed piece of legislation. And even with amendments that could fix some of the major problems, it needs to have adequate judicial review to ensure that the provisions that are included, even if they're improved, can be enforced as Congress intends. We need to be able to move forward and allow people to take advantage of the rights that they may be granted in whatever legislation moves through Congress. It took decades for Congress, for DHS, for the Department of Homeland Security and the prior iterations, the INS and so forth, to actually enforce the rights that have been accorded under prior immigration bills, the 1986 and 1996 bills. And those rights have only been enforceable through judicial process. And in part by the ACLU and the other organizations that are here, we have worked very hard to ensure that people have been actually able to enjoy some of their legal rights. But it has taken a great amount of work, and the bill that's now before the Senate actually cuts way back on judicial review and makes many of the new rights meaningless. This bill is a step backwards. And one of the major concerns that we have is with the employment eligibility verification system. This system is highly flawed. This could, because of the trigger system that's in the legislation, if EVES, the employer eligibility system, is not in place, no one can actually move forward and no rights can be accorded to people to become U.S. citizens. But the way the system is constructed, it will make it incredibly hard for anybody who is denied rights. The system itself is very unwieldy. If when the EVES system is in place and someone is denied a job because the system says they're not eligible, there is really no system in place that allows them to challenge that. There is a purported review, but the way it's constructed, it makes it almost impossible for anybody to actually change that. There's no back wages if someone's denied. The legal review is very limited, and the cost could be extremely high for anybody to move forward. So what we need is major fixes to this legislation. It needs to have provisions that allow people to actually enforce their rights. The EVES system needs to have significant privacy protections, and it needs to make sure that people who are denied the right to work have the ability to fix the data in the system without an incredible cost to themselves. And so we will work with our allies, with MALDEF and with the AFL-CIO and others to ensure that the bill is significantly improved before it passes. So with that, I'll turn it over to John Trusvina on the phone from MALDEF.
Thank you, Caroline, and good afternoon, everybody. I'm up in New York today, and I'm not up on all of the details. My colleague, Eric Gutierrez, who's our point person in the Washington office from all of us on the line, I'm going to turn it over to him for some brief remarks, but just two or three points that raise our concerns at MALDEF. And I think the Senate was right to take up a bill and take it up with overwhelming vote last night, but there are significant changes that are going to be needed before this bill gets through the Senate or gets enacted. Just to follow up on what Caroline was describing, the concerns with the employment verification system and how it relates to challenges. The employment verification system, all the rules are shielded from challenge. So there is any challenge must be brought within 90 days, and after the regulation is first implemented. And there will be a lot of issues that won't really come to light until after that period of time. And second is that the compromise takes off the table the possibility of a court, bars the court from certifying a class a challenge to this, and it also bars the court from awarding attorney fees. These are just things that are put in order to shield the program from working effectively. I was a special counsel for immigration-related unfair employment practices during the Clinton administration, and INS regularly briefed my office and me on the basic pilot systems, the various ones that were being implemented on a test basis. And invariably, the employers who had just been trained by INS got the basic systems wrong. And we fear that moving into employment verification system so quickly under this bill will lead to a lot of discrimination, will lead to a lot of employer error. It sets up a number of things that are unworkable. There are other significant barriers to citizenship under the bill, including a cost and other measures that will create an artificial barrier to family reunification. So we have a number of issues and concerns with the bill, and we will seek to have them remedied both in the Senate and in the House as this process goes forward. In terms of some of the Title II provisions, Eric, if you could just fill in a couple of examples of our concerns, that would be helpful.
Sure. Let me just start off with thanking everyone for the teleconference today, and thank you, Caroline, for your opening remarks. Let me just talk a little bit about the due process and immigration proceedings and also judicial review. The compromise permits judicial review of legalization applications only if an individual is in removal proceedings, and those who are denied legalization will ultimately face a very difficult choice. Either they place themselves in removal proceedings, or if they fail to appeal within 30 days, they lose all rights to challenge the denial unless they are in removal proceedings in the future. And we believe that judicial review should be available without any obstacles for any agency decision. On a positive note, the bill does not contain any of the harsh provisions that were included in past proposals that would have restricted judicial view of other immigration laws and proceedings, and we anticipate that there may be several votes on amendments that threaten to create additional barriers to court review, and of course we're working diligently to ensure that the Senate opposes any of those amendments that would limit judicial review. There are some issues in terms of automatic imprisonment without due process. The bill expands the detention system by adding 20,000 beds and allows the use of closed military bases for immigration detention. The detention system needs to be reformed to expand alternatives to detention rather than adding more beds to already broken detention system. In terms of the U.S. Supreme Court decision against indefinite detention of immigrants, the Senate compromise would undercut two vital Supreme Court cases. One of them is Advaitis versus Davis. The other is Clark versus Martinez that held that the Immigration Service does not have the authority outside of a judicial process to impose indefinite detention. This provision seeks to grant the Department of Homeland Security new authority to indefinitely detain without any due process protections, and it would allow DHS to detain people who have already served their time. In terms of some of the minor offenses that should not result in deportation, the bill includes heightened penalties related to passport and document fraud and expands the definition of those crimes. There's stiff penalties for document fraud that already exist in the criminal code, and this provision further heightens those penalties. On a positive note, several of the provisions included in last year's bill that would have expanded the aggravated felony category were not included in this bill, so we're thankful for that, including one that related to driving under the influence. Let me finish off by talking a little bit about some of the bars. In addition to the existing criminal bars, in terms of being eligible for the legalization program, including DREAM Act and ag jobs, if you've ever been convicted of one felony or three misdemeanors, you would be made ineligible. And misdemeanors could potentially include very minor offenses such as traffic violations or loitering. And these individuals, you know, should not be excluded from legalization just based on petty minor offenses. The bill finally also includes permanent bars to relief for individuals who overstay their visas in the future. Permanent exclusion from legal status is an extraordinarily harsh punishment for overstaying a visa, and there is no provision that would allow DHS discretion to determine if this harsh punishment fits the crime. So those are really the highlights of some of the due process issues in terms of the current detention and deportation system, and we'd be happy to answer any questions afterwards. Thank you.
Right. Thank you very much, John and Eric. Now I'd like to turn it over to Ana Avendano with the AFL-CIO.
Thank you, Caroline, and thanks, John.
Yes, you could turn the mics over just a little bit. Great.
And I'm happy to be here with you today, and I want to echo the same concerns about this bill generally that Caroline and John have articulated. From the standpoint of working people, this bill does not fix the broken immigration system, and in fact, it doesn't deal workers a fair hand. The AFL-CIO believes that any immigration reform legislation has to guarantee equal and enforceable rights to all workers. The current system has created a two-tiered society. Our labor and employment laws simply don't protect undocumented workers. In fact, in some states, undocumented workers have no standing to complain about discrimination or about workplace injuries. That means that workers aren't even allowed to bring a case to court. So the result is that we now have an entire class of workers, numbering in the more than 10 million, who are paid substandard wages and often have no choice but to work in substandard conditions, and because of their immigration status, cannot exercise their fundamental right to join or form a union. Immigration reform has to do away with that secondary class of workers. And for that, we need to have a fair, simple, and very clear path to legalization. And we also need to ensure that we're not creating another secondary class of workers in the future by opening up failed guest worker programs. Unfortunately, the bill that was introduced in the Senate today, or the deal that was struck last week, doesn't meet those fundamental principles. It doesn't adequately raise the floor for workers because the legalization program is so difficult, is so onerous, that it's going to exclude a whole host of people. We don't know how many yet. For example, one of the requirements in the program is that people who are now undocumented and want to remain in the U.S. have to stay employed continually, full-time employed continually. The bill makes no allowance for workers who get hurt on the job and can't work because of that, or workers who are in a car accident or have to take care of a sick child or any other condition that preclude normal people from being able to work full-time year-round. All it does is provide a safe harbor, so to speak, for force majeure, which are acts of God. So if there's an earthquake or a hurricane, then workers will be okay. We're also deeply troubled by just the nature of how the bill addresses the future flow of workers in the United States. We know when we accept that there are going to be labor shortages in our country. What we fundamentally believe is that we should welcome workers who come to our nation in the future as full partners in our society with full rights in our workplace. And that cannot happen if we do that, if we import workers through a temporary worker program. We support reform of the existing employment-based visa system, which is really arbitrary. What we are supporting is modifying that program so it's tied to real economic indicators. Instead, what this bill does is actually radically change the nature of U.S. immigration policy, which has always limited temp worker programs, guest worker programs, to be seasonal, to fill short-term or spot labor shortages. Now, through this program, employers are going to be able to import hundreds of thousands of workers a year. It's estimated by the 10th year, there'll be more than 3.5 million temporary workers here, laboring in permanent jobs under temporary status. That doesn't make any sense for workers. That just guarantees that employers are going to have a steady pool of workers that they can exploit economically for a substantial period of time. Finally, the law again builds on another fatally flawed approach through to employer sanctions. One of the most fundamental problems that workers have had with the Immigration Reform and Control Act, IRCA, which created the employment verification system, is that it's become a tool for employers to suppress worker rights, because employers are essentially deputized to be agents of INS. And they use that power when workers try to organize or when workers claim a workplace injury. All of a sudden, employers begin to check the status of workers. This bill does nothing to address concerns with that. In fact, it just builds on the failed basic pilot program, which, as people have said, has fundamental flaws because it has encouraged discrimination. It has bad data in it. What we need is a real system that's going to disincentivize employers from exploiting workers and therefore doing away with the incentive that there is right now to bring and exploit and recruit undocumented workers. We, too, are working with our allies in Congress and in the immigrant rights community to make sure that the major problems with this bill, which are many, are mitigated, and that we hope that we'll be able, at least someday, in the House at least, to bring a fair and comprehensive solution to the immigration crisis to working people in the state. Thanks.
Thank you. Thank you, Anna. We're going to open it up to questions now, but I just want to make one additional point, which I think has not been adequately considered by the press and by members of Congress, and that is that the employer verification system is actually going to affect all Americans. And I think people tend to think that somehow it's directed just at new immigrants, but all of us are going to be subject to the system. And therefore, the flaws that are inherent, as Anna was saying, the data problems that have been rampant in the pilot program, which will be extremely expanded by this program, will now affect all of us. And for all Americans, as they change jobs, as they enter the workforce for the first time, are going to be subject to a very, very poorly constructed system with a very difficult way to challenge bad data, very expensive process to get actually into the workforce. And so this really needs to be fixed. So with that, we'll open it up for questions. I do want to mention that we have here also from the ACLU, Max Sevilla and Tim Sparapani. And again, John Tresvina and Eric Gutierrez on the phone, available for questions.
Okay. At this time, if you have a question, simply press 1 on your touch-tone phone now. Please only press 1 once. If you press it twice, it will remove you from the queue.
Okay. We have a question here live right now.
Do you guys want to get rid of the guest worker program completely, or would you be comfortable with cutting the program in half from 400,000 to 200,000? As proposed by Senator Boehner.
Can you turn all the mics towards?
Again, just the size of the guest worker program is not the ultimate problem. The ultimate problem is that we're creating a mechanism by which employers can import temporary workers who are, by their very nature, not able to exercise their rights to do permanent jobs in the U.S. So, yes, to the extent that the program is smaller than it would have been otherwise, that's an improvement, but it's not the solution.
Yeah, the deep flaws in the program are not the number, they are in the way the workers are brought in, including that only the families can come in only of higher income workers, and even at that point, because the workers have to leave after 2 years, have to stay out a year, the next time they come in, they can't bring in their family. We think people ought to be coming in not as labor machinery, but as full immigrants.
So if I can rephrase that, basically you would prefer that the program, if it existed, it provided a pathway to residency.
We would prefer that when future workers come into the United States, they come in with full rights. That the minute they walk in the door, the minute they walk into the workplace, they have a lawful permanent status, which allows them to exercise their rights. So it's not unheard of. We have an employment-based system right now, and the question really should be, why are we not focusing on that? Why are we trying to create a solution that's based on turning permanent jobs into temporary jobs?
That's what the employment-based system come in with now, full rights.
Uh-huh. Well, Anna, you don't sound particularly optimistic for chances in the Senate of getting adequate changes to the bill. Is that an accurate read, that you feel like your changes are going to have to come in the House, potentially?
Well, to be honest,
this process is moving so quickly, and it has moved so outside of, you know, just behind closed doors that I really don't know what to say. I mean, it was only like yesterday that we saw the final language of this bill that was going to the floor. So we don't know where the votes are right now. We don't really know what's going to happen. Just the whole nature of the process leads us to believe that there isn't going to be a lot of room for public input.
But, I mean, are you working, are you contacting any senators about possible amendments?
Of course.
Because I know there's a group of 12 that meets every day, and they go over the amendments and the schedule, and they kind of decide, you know, they're going to vote against any amendment that alters the, you know, the status or the,
right,
the substance of the bill.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's part of the normal legislative process. All of the legislative directors for the 54 AFL-CIO-affiliated unions meet regularly to craft strategies on various pieces of legislation. And since this is one of our top legislative priorities, we've been doing that consistently over the last few months.
And we all have. And, you know, I think one of the issues really is what is the core of the bill. I don't think anybody really has an understanding of that yet. As I understand, Senator Feinstein, who is one of the 12, is a co-sponsor of Senator Bingaman's amendment that would cut the guest worker program in half. So I think there are a lot of questions that remain. One of the things that I'm very hopeful about is the fact that there is now the recess, the congressional recess that's going to fall in the middle of the consideration of this bill. And I think a lot of senators are going to hear from their constituents, are going to hear from members of all of our organizations who have deep concerns about this legislation. If they want any immigration legislation that goes forward to have adequate protections for people's legal rights in the workplace and elsewhere, so that the bill that purports to provide certain rights actually has enforceable rights.
And if you have your concerns about the temporary worker program, what's your opinion on Byron Dorgan's proposal to basically take it out completely?
Well, at the ACLU, this hasn't been a major focus of ours, but I would say, you know, essentially, I think what Anna was saying about any type of program that limits people's basic rights is inherently flawed from our point of view, because if people can't actually protect themselves from discrimination or not being paid the wages that they were promised to be paid or have separation of family, I think that's a problem from a civil rights and civil liberties point of view. But I don't know if you want to speak to the amendment.
There is no reason why future flows should be filled with temporary workers, and that's not to say that there shouldn't be a mechanism for workers to come into the United States in the future. One of the failures of IRCA, the last large immigration reform law, was exactly that there wasn't a mechanism, a new mechanism, to allow future workers to come into the United States. So we have long lines for permanent visas, and that's just not been useful. That's one of the reasons why we have a large undocumented population. We need to focus on fixing that problem. Going through temporary worker programs does not fix that problem. Every single congressional committee who has studied this issue and asked the same questions you're asking now in 1977, in the Jordan Commission in the 80s, has come to the same conclusion. Temporary worker programs are a failure.
But from Malta's perspective, the answer isn't to reduce the number to 200,000 or to zero. The answer is to get a worker program that does have the rights that are needed. I would be concerned if the recess resulted in the Senate taking up no bill. And I think every day that goes by is a day that people are being split from families, subject to deportation. We do need a bill, but we need the right bill. The legalization program, for the most part, gets it right. There are a lot of details about the costs and about some of the eligibilities in the later years. But that is a very important part of this legislation that, while we focus on some of the shortcomings, we shouldn't also omit the fact that this does have a legalization program that covers people starting as of December 31st, 2006.
Is there any response to Lundgren's intervention?
Just so that John can hear, can you speak louder?
Any reaction to Congressman Lundgren introducing legislation yesterday?
It's a question from CNN.
No.
If you reporters wouldn't mind identifying yourself when you ask the questions, I think so that our people on the phone know.
Yeah, I'm Kevin McGowan with Daily Labor Report. And I just had a question about the everything is very interconnected and intertwined in this bill. Do you have any sense, and maybe you don't at this point, you know, obviously the legalization program is sort of the carrot, and then there's these sticks that are in the bill too. Do you have a sense of which, you know, sticks you can remove without making the carrot less likely to be enacted?
I don't. Like Caroline said, we don't know what the core principles that, I mean, this is a deal, right? So this wasn't just a bipartisan bill. It was a deal that was negotiated, and it was difficult negotiations from what we understand. We don't know what the core fundamental principles of that deal are.
At the same time, the Senate in 1988 overwhelmingly passed a point system, overwhelmingly got rid of some of the family preferences, 88-4. The House rejected it, and then they came around the next year, and the House similarly rejected a point system and some other provisions. So all we have right now is a compromise between very, very important senators abroad across the spectrum and the White House. The House, the other House, hasn't spoken. So there is a way of this bill passing the Senate, but the House taking up an entirely different structure and then getting it resolved in conference.
This is Tim Sparapani from the ACLU. I would just echo what was just said by the previous two speakers, and I would say that part of the view that we're getting from the bill is that there's a sense that the provisions as written are currently unworkable. So it's not a question about which stick or which carrot you can fix, but whether you have the right sticks and the right carrots. And it seems like, in particular, a provision which hasn't received a lot of attention is the provision in Title III to screen every worker before they get provided a job or are allowed to take their next job. If that provision doesn't work, not only are you going to have regression, not reform, for immigrants who want to move on the path toward citizenship, you're going to have a whole lot of the 160 million people in America who are part of the workforce currently very frustrated, and they're going to rebel against this system. So it's really critical that that language in Title III be overhauled to provide real opportunities for individuals to make sure that the government has the right data about them, that they are able to work and get their next job quickly and efficiently. And if we don't do that, the way the bill is set up with the trigger system, the rest of the legalization provisions don't kick in. So it's really essential that we go back and review and modify substantially Title III of this bill.
Are there any questions on the phone?
We do have one question from, please only press one once. If you press it twice, it is removing you from the queue. Alvin Besant with Newsday.
Hi. Can you hear me?
Yes.
I'm curious about something. Both the provisions for legalization and for the guest worker program require at some point that people go back to their home countries. Heads of households in the legalization, but everyone in the guest worker program. Is that workable, or do you see problems there?
Well, this is Caroline Fredrickson. I said I would leave this one to Anna and John, but I think it seems essentially unworkable just from a practical point of view, that people actually leave and the cost that's involved. But Anna and John, I think, work on that more specifically than we do.
Right. Caroline is absolutely right. I mean, if you look at it from a social policy standpoint, what good does it do our society to punish people by forcing them to go back, touch base, and simply process again through one of the American consulates? That's just a purely punitive measure.
I'm sorry, who was speaking?
This is Anna Avendano from the AFL-CIO. That's one of those things that's going to prevent a whole lot of people from coming forward to get the status, because they know that if they come forward and get their initial visa, they're going to have to provide biometric data. They're going to have to provide all kinds of information to the government. Then the government is going to process that. If they deny that visa, then the person is going to be referred to immigration for removal from the country. There's a whole bunch of disincentives like that built into this legalization program that is going to guarantee that a whole bunch of people are, A, not going to apply, and, B, not going to be actually benefiting from this new Z visa in the program.
Anything that makes it more difficult for employers to use the system or workers to use the system will mean that people will continue to hire and be hired outside the system, and will not have moved forward. The INS back in the 80s and 90s concluded that this requirement to go back and leave the country, all it did was benefit the foreign airlines. So to have a system where you have to go back to your home country. Earlier versions of the compromise talked about leaving the United States or going to a port of entry.
Mm-hmm.
So you could go to Windsor, you could go to Ciudad Juarez, and that would be more acceptable and it could be done in a way that people knew that they were, when they went on the trip, they knew they were coming back in and coming back in a relatively quick period. On the guest worker program, to require people to leave after 2 years and stay out for a year and then come back in without family for another 2 years and then leave again for a year, that again makes it difficult for employers, also makes it difficult for the workers involved, and thus not used.
More questions from the phone?
One quick follow-up. Is it possible to reach Ms. Avendano offline?
Yes. My phone number is 202-637-3949.
Any other questions from the phone?
Our next question, Tom Brune from Newsday as well. Go ahead, Mr. Brune.
Oh, thank you. This is Tom Brune at Newsday. Well, I guess we're doing a Newsday press conference. I wanted to know, do you have sponsors lined up in the Senate to offer some amendments to change the bill that would meet some of these objections?
Well, we're working with a number of offices. Nothing has been nailed down yet. As you know, that the process itself is still being sort of played out in terms of when amendments are going to be offered and by whom.
Mm-hmm.
Tim, I don't know if you want to speak to that. No. I think it's sort of a moving target right now, and we do have a lot of relationships, and we've been working for, well, several years now on this legislation, so we expect to see the amendments, but I can't tell you exactly who will offer or what the content will be.
Okay, thank you.
Other questions on the phone?
We have another question from Shabar with Press Trust of India.
Yeah. Hello?
Hello?
Yeah, I'm with the Press Trust of India. But I was wondering if you had any serious reservations or opinions on the H-1B program that is being suggested in the Senate bill.
I would turn that to Anya.
Absolutely. I mean, there's the program with the problems with temporary worker programs are not just in the low-wage labor market programs like the H-2B program, but also the H-1B program. Right now, H-1B employers who bring in H-1B workers into the high technology sector don't have to test the U.S. labor market at all. They don't have to offer the job to any workers in local communities or anywhere in the country. They just file an attestation and they bring workers in. Now, this hasn't worked well for the H-1B workers or for other workers, immigrant and domestic-born, who are working in the high-tech industry. Wages, and not just wages, but compensation packages have declined in that industry over the years, and we've seen rampant abuse. According to the General Accounting Office itself, there is very little monitoring of the H-1B program. And I think that the H-1B program is a very important program to review, because that program was created in 1998 as an answer to the spot labor shortage, to what President Clinton declared to be a crisis in America because we didn't have enough high-tech workers at that time. That was 1998, and the plan was to put enough funds and enough effort to training high school kids here, workers who are already here, regardless of their citizenship, regardless of their immigration status, so that they would have access to good-paying high-tech jobs. That has not happened. The H-1B program has set caps on wages in that industry, and it really has encouraged employers like Microsoft to turn more and more and more to that program to fill high-tech jobs. What employers are telling us on one hand is American workers are too smart, too educated to do the jobs that, quote, Americans won't do because that's a low-wage labor market job, and so we need a temp worker program for low-wage workers. Then they're telling us, well, we don't have enough high-skilled workers, so we need a guest worker program to fill high-skilled jobs. The bottom line is that employers just like these programs because they control wages and they have a ready pool of workers that can't exercise their rights.
So what would be your remedy here?
The remedy is what we've been talking about right now, is that we have an employment-based system for immigration into this country. It's working well. It's just not tied to economic indicators. So there's 140,000 visas available for workers. That's an arbitrary number. It was negotiated among Senate staff, Congress, House staff. Our proposal is to look at that number and tie it to real economic indicators so that if there is a labor shortage in the high-tech industry, for example, and there's a need to bring in 200,000 workers, then those workers should come in with green cards. And if there isn't, if there is 5,000 workers needed, then that many workers come in with green cards. But then the number of workers who are coming into our economy actually reflect the economic needs, the real economic needs of employers in the economy, not this desire to drive down wages.
Thank you. And you are again, please?
I'm Anna Avendano with the AFL-CIO.
Thank you very much.
Any other questions on the phone?
Not at this time.
Any other questions here? Okay.
I just have a quick question for Mr. Gutierrez. He mentioned the suspension. I'm sorry, I'm Suzanne with Associated Press.
Eric, can you hear?
Yes, uh-huh.
He mentioned this, the detention issue, and I'm sorry, I just didn't understand it. About only being in removal proceedings when rights kicking or something like that. And I was wondering if you could just explain that once more.
Right. I mean, the bill permits, like, review of the overall legalization program, but there's time limits, creates restrictions, time limits that will impede the ability of non-citizens to challenge the way the government administers the program. So that's a little more, I guess, open, I guess. But in terms of the legalization program, it permits judicial review of legalization applications only if an individual is in removal proceedings. And those who are denied legalization will face a difficult choice. They'll have to either get in the removal proceedings, or if they fail to appeal within 30 days, then they lose all the rights to challenge. This is another way of ensuring that the legalization program is fairly restrictive. And if someone decides to come in, I'm not sure if the bill also does not include a confidentiality clause, which most of the other bills had, which would ensure that when someone presents themselves, affirmatively says, I'm in the country undocumented and I believe that I'm eligible, that would protect them. So this is another way of, in a way, putting someone at risk.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Any other questions? No. Well, then, thank you very much for those of you who called in. Thanks to John, Eric, and Anna for joining us here at the ACLU, and thanks to all of you. And please follow up with any of us if you have further questions or want additional background. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks, everyone.